songs 10, 20, 100 times, trying to understand what was connecting me to the song. I listened over and over to figure out what was layered in there, which is the same way I try to figure out how something is cooked. I try to discern the layers. Painting started out as a way for me to purge, to let out a lot of pain and turmoil, but it turned into something incredibly joyous. Quite honestly, it's surprising to me how much I love some of my pieces. That's something I never, ever could have imagined. I never could have imagined that my art would affect other people either. And most of all, I never could have imagined looking at some of my art and thinking that if I saw it in a gallery, I would love it. Every time I take on a challenge, or I become interested in going down a new avenue, I learn something about myself. It's another piece of a puzzle that I didn't realize was so big or complex, but that complexity is rewarding. Over the past 20-plus years, I've steadily become more appreciative of culinary skills and the artistry of being able to cook, which shouldn't be confused with actually being able to do it. But in our own way, we can use whatever skills or imagination we have to try. There's nothing wrong with being proud that you boiled water for the first time. Everything starts at step one. We can't get to step 20 if we don't start somewhere. Success starts with trying. God knows I've made enough food that I took a bite of and threw away, but it hasn't stopped me. It showed me that I did something wrong. I try to be my own harshest critic and to learn from my culinary mistakes as much as I learn from all my mistakes. Aaron's love of baking and my love of cooking have sparked a can-do kitchen adventure for all three of our young ones, which has them inventing their own culinary creations. Being creative in our house is so much the norm, and the idea of can-do as opposed to can't-do is so much a part of our day that it has been both amusing and fulfilling to have Colin and Sarah, who are both amazingly athletic and terrific students at school, also take such a liking to food and to cooking. But one day I was in the kitchen just as Colin was pulling from the oven some sugar cookies he had baked from scratch. He announced very matter-of-factly that he and Sarah were going to make a Granny Smith apple pie. I smiled, but also sensed possible disaster. Even so, their curiosity and obvious commitment to doing it were so palpable that both Aaron and I said, "That's great." They told us they were going to make the pie crust from scratch, which in itself would be challenging, and then they started cutting up apples. Aaron and I left them alone for hours, and lo and behold, when we came back downstairs, there was a beautiful apple pie. It even had lattice work on the top. We were stunned. That pie took me back to my making pants for Jean and myself when we played the Hotel Diplomat in 1973. My parents told me that they appreciated my tenacity, but they thought making those pants was pretty much impractical and out of reach. Mind you, I managed to make two great pairs of pants, even though every step of the way, from cutting the fabric to putting in the zippers, I was told it would be impossible. My parents appreciated my effort, but they didn't think it would come to anything. The difference with my children is that Aaron and I cheer them on, and now, here was this beautiful apple pie in front of us. When Colin and Sarah asked us to sit down to have a piece, Aaron and I looked at each other. Now the fun stops. Then I took a bite of it. It was mind-blowing. And I told them that. I said, "I would be proud if I'd made this. It's amazingly good." Which was followed quickly by Aaron saying, "And you kids are making the pies for Thanksgiving." Their sheer can-do spirit, coupled with a naivety about what is possible, brought the results that maybe in some ways mirrored my success with the band and Aaron's success as an attorney. Perhaps when we don't know how difficult something is going to be, it isn't that difficult after all. We can use whatever skills or imagination we have, and then just try. I'm certainly not a chef, but I like cooking the way a chef might like playing guitar. It doesn't make the chef a rock star, and liking to cook doesn't make me a chef, but I take joy in being able to feed my family and myself and make nice food. Cooking turns a house into a home, because eating food we make ourselves fills the shell of a house with the life of a home. With cooking, I kept adding fundamental skills, like deglazing a pan, which is a fancy term for pouring some liquid, usually some form of alcohol, into a frying pan and making sure you scrape up all the flavorable bits of food clinging to the bottom so that flavor infuses whatever it is you're cooking, rather than just making the pan tough to scrub out later. I needed someone to open a door for me. If we can find somebody to help us, it's foolish not to take the help. The only dumb question is the one we don't ask. There's so much experience around us that to close our ears and make believe we know everything only hurts us. In my case, I started messaging chefs through Twitter and asking them questions. That's how I learned to deglaze my pan with some Marsala wine and chicken stock to get the concentrated flavors in the bottom of the pan. I once tried to make a pasta dish with chicken and peas, and it seemed easy enough, but when I tasted the results, it was unremarkable. In that instance, I messaged Rocco DiSpirito. What was the problem with the dish? Turns out, it starts at the beginning. You have to build what they call a sofrito. You have to build your flavors at the beginning with your herbs, with your stock. You have to deglaze your pan. Without the fundamentals, you can't make a great dish. God is in the details. God is also in the nuances. It's those subtleties we miss that make something great. At a restaurant recently, I had to remark that something I was eating was just heavy-handed. And yet those same ingredients in the right hands would have been in proportions that worked. Maybe food is no different from anything else in life. It's all about proportions. It's all about what takes the lead and what supports it. And though I'm far from being a chef, it's the little things I can learn that become the building blocks to something else. Whether it's building a wardrobe from one jacket, one shirt, and one pair of pants, or building up a recipe collection by starting with one dish. Suddenly, with help, I had a good dish. And then I realized I could do something similar with shrimp. And just like with my jacket, shirt, tie chart, I was off to the races. I've got a long way to go, but as naive and elementary as it sounds, that is so exciting to me. I made this pasta with chicken and chicken stock and Marsala wine. I did it right. And it was the key that opened a door that had been closed. That sort of thing, a basic accomplishment like making an awesome pasta dish, is exciting. I would have been chasing my tail, but a little bit of knowledge and guidance started me on another journey. Armed with that knowledge and guidance, I've been able to put a personal stamp on the food in my home. I'm not making Michelin-star dishes, but I'm making good, tasty food. And I'm not skipping dessert, Doc. I mean, is there a good substitute for ice cream? Fuck no. So, eat the ice cream. And enjoy it. For myself, I'll have my ice cream and then figure out something else to sacrifice. But if I'm going to have dessert, I want the real thing. Some things can't be replaced, and there's no reasonable facsimile of ice cream. Also, certain savory dishes just need fat. You simply can't make certain foods with lean meat. You have to have the fat. A good hamburger has to have 20 to 30% fat. The discipline we have in what we don't eat allows us the freedom to eat what we do eat. There really is a way to do it without feeling that we have to eat sawdust to be healthy. Some things just can't be replaced. Eat the ice cream. That's what life is about. Chapter 17. If we keep moving forward, we never finish the journey. At this point, I've reached the mountaintop in the field of music. But I want to replicate the high. There's a hunger to find another means of replicating that feeling of accomplishment and validation. I don't think that goes away. That feeling of getting to know another side of yourself and getting to see what you're capable of is built on your prior accomplishments. Any of the guys who originally went into space as astronauts had to start out as student pilots, after all. Our success opens doors to other possibilities, and we want to get the same psychological rush of fulfillment, if not the same adrenaline rush, of seeing what we're capable of. I'm always looking to see what more I'm capable of, not because of any feelings of inferiority, but because it enhances what's already there. At this point in my life, it helps to broaden the picture, add to the mosaic. It helps to create a bigger sense of who I am, and it's uplifting, if only because I surprise myself by what I can do. We all can surprise ourselves by what we can do. When you achieve success, some people will try to intimidate you, but for God's sake, don't intimidate yourself. That's a mistake many people make. They intimidate themselves and don't let themselves experiment. The joy of creating something tangible from the intangible is one of the most gratifying experiences I have in life. Any outlet that I've found for expressing myself has helped me to define myself. So from the very beginning, as soon as I picked up a guitar, I wanted to write songs. I wanted to express myself. If for no one else but myself, I wanted to hear my own thoughts. In writing books, I wanted to express my own thoughts. In painting, I wanted to see my own thoughts. All vehicles for interpretation. It wasn't always that way for me. I rejected art as a path back in high school. From an early age, I sketched and drew at home, and quite honestly, I couldn't understand why nobody else could draw as well. I would look at something, and while I looked at it to draw it, my eye would connect to my hand. It was second nature. By the time I got to school, I was very comfortable with my artistic ability. When I was in grade school, we used to do an assignment they called a product map, which was a map of a state showing the state's industries. It would be done on a large piece of oak tag. That's what we called it, like poster board. The boards would be about 3 feet by 3.5 feet, and every kid dreaded having to do them. But it took me only 5 minutes. I could just look at a map of a state and draw an enlarged version freehand. Despite my comfort with my artistic ability, over time I found myself not ultimately committed to it. I just wasn't motivated enough, and I guess that goes back to not being excited enough. I wasn't eager enough to put in the time. Hence, when I got to the High School of Music and Art, which I commuted from Queens into Manhattan to attend, I encountered people who were not only as good as me, but far better. That only made me that much more committed to music, which is something I never stopped working at. I've never been good at taking direction. I've never been good at dealing with authority figures. I've never been good at working to someone else's schedule. However, nobody works harder, is more motivated, or can deliver more dependably than I can. But outside of what I choose to do, I'm not very good at bending to other people's rules. I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the great modern painters, before they went into abstract phases, learned the techniques of painting realistically. For those artists, it was a calling. It was something they felt compelled to do. And the way for many of them, I guess, was they started in art school and under tutelage. I totally understand that, and it's probably what makes their work so timeless, deep, and great. That being said, I'm not of that school. While I find all those great artists inspiring, I don't have the time, patience, or wherewithal to backtrack. I was not an aspiring artist. I've come back to art as a diversion, as a place where I can express myself without being judged or thinking about anyone's expectations. So I'm coming to it now from a different place. Painting, untrained as I am, fulfills a need in me, and the creative outlet is satisfying as it is. I've never been somebody who does things by the book, and I'm also aware that I will never be a Picasso, which is just fine. This doesn't mean that my art can't affect somebody as much as a great artist's work can. It's definitely gratifying when someone connects to one of my paintings, but I don't have the foundation or schooling that contemporary artists do now. When I started painting again, I had no guidance, and I liked that a lot. It may seem like I'm contradicting myself, but I've enjoyed the purity of figuring it out on my own. It's important for each of us to know what we are and who we are, and not try to be something we're not. It's something that applies to all areas of life. I'm never going to be a master artist. It would be pointless to try. I can't do that. And yet, doing it the way I do, putting in real effort and passion even while I'm aware of my limitations, works. It's crazy to look for perfection or not settle for less than perfection, because we'll always be unhappy. The truth is, we're not settling for less, we're dealing with reality. I realized in the past 20 years or so that nothing in life is perfect. If we accept the imperfection in life, we see things more realistically. Happiness comes from accepting imperfection and determining how to deal with it. It's not negative to say that the world is imperfect, that relationships are imperfect, that life is imperfect. If we embrace this, we remove the desire for an ideal that will always leave us dissatisfied. We're not lowering the bar. We're accepting reality. That's a good thing. The world is beautiful despite imperfection, or even because of it. Of course, life intervenes in other ways too. We're all faced with deadlines to one degree or another, as well as obligations or responsibilities that are part of everyday life. For me, the idea of creating on a schedule or on demand, which was how it worked at the art school, seemed contrary to creativity. In part, that was due to my counterproductive pursuit of perfection. But certainly as an adolescent and a teen, I didn't want something that I did out of spontaneity and a sense of freedom to suddenly be harnessed. Over time, with music, I found that spontaneity could work. But we can't become prisoners to inspiration. We have to use it as a tool. If we just wait around to be inspired, we'll probably do a lot less, and we'd be a whole lot less creative. Early in Kiss's career, our business manager told me we needed to go in and do another album, that I had to write songs, and quickly. I said, "Well, I'm not really feeling inspired right now." And he said, "I'll show you your bills and you'll get inspired." The trick is to manage both inspiration and creativity without compromising either. I certainly want to be proud of whatever I do, but I also want to keep the creative juices constantly flowing. The reason I don't have a lot of unrecorded songs around is because at some point in the creative process, I didn't believe they were good enough. Once I start to explore an idea, be it a riff or chord pattern, if it's worth pursuing, I'll go on to a melody, but if it's not, I'll chuck it. In the course of writing the melody and lyrics, I'll listen and think, this isn't good enough, and get rid of it. It seems pointless to complete something I know isn't up to my standards when I could be spending that time doing something of value. I've become much better at it. In the early days, I would go further before abandoning ideas. They say, old too soon, smart too late. As we age, it becomes clearer that the time we spend on something is time we can never get back. Time becomes more precious as it marches on. This goes back to the conveyor belt of life. We never get back the time it takes to complete something that we know isn't great, just as we never get back the time wasted on a dead-end relationship. What's the point of pursuing something if it's only an exercise in mediocrity? It's a waste of time. In the old days, I had hours of tape of almost stream of consciousness applied to music, just letting my hands go and see what came out. But I would record over the tapes. Even now, when there's basically unlimited capacity to record, I work the same way, because more important than storage capacity is time. Time truly is the one thing we can't buy. Everything I do creatively sparks my need and necessitates my taking the next step. So whether it's songwriting or art or anything else, Every piece I do spurs me to the next. And nothing that I'm doing today could I have done a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The excitement is the inspiration I get from something I did yesterday, which pushes me to what I can do today, often something that I couldn't have conceived of or possibly created yesterday. It's a constant process of evolution that builds on itself. There was a time when I felt let down at the end of a tour or at the end of an album because I'd worked so hard to open up those creative channels and then they were going to close, and I would in some ways have to start from square one again. Once something is moving, once it's rolling along, momentum will keep it going, and having to stop it for any reason means having to start it again from being still. What I found is that at this stage in my life, keeping those creative channels open almost accelerates the progress. When I ski, I have to be careful about gaining momentum and picking up speed, but nobody ever got a concussion from painting or writing a song. Once we open a faucet and let any undrinkable, rusty water run out, we have the opportunity to keep it flowing. And the more it flows, the less chance we have of going back to that stagnant situation. It's all intertwined, and the same laws apply to everything. Creativity, sense of self, it's all tied together, and it all builds on itself. Keeping my creative juices flowing, just like keeping my emotions flowing, affects my outlook and how I deal with people every day. When the taps are open, we can see things differently. We can let go of old notions, old opinions, old ideas. As our vision becomes clearer, the screen becomes bigger. What becomes important in relationships and what no longer matters changes. Because when we are fulfilled in different ways, we place less importance on some of the things that had importance to us previously. Misplaced importance in relationships or misplaced priorities can recede and become irrelevant as we find outlets that enrich us and define us. As for the practical elements, to be our most creative, we need to be able to turn wherever we are into a solitary space. The substance of more creativity is always there because it's within us. It's within me. And the only variable from person to person is how much what goes on around us sabotages our ability to get to it. Some people need a cabin in the woods with birds singing and a babbling brook, but I don't believe it has to do with location. It has to do with mindset. If we can immerse ourselves in what we're doing and lose ourselves, then it's just a matter of whether or not our environment allows us to do that. We don't become inspired because we're away from home, nor do I think we become inspired just because we're home. Ultimately, any location can result in obstructions or roadblocks. We have to get rid of those as much as possible so we can lose ourselves and allow inspiration to come from inside. I try to put the same sort of effort and inspiration into everything. I'm not aspiring to become a professional chef, and I'm not aspiring to make painting my primary job, yet I still find value in putting energy into those things. It's essential because what I've found and what has been reaffirmed over the years is that every time I find another means of self-expression, I'm that much happier. I find life that much more exhilarating. The reason I've gone back to painting after initially rejecting drawing and other forms of visual art is that painting is more multi-leveled. I'm dealing with textures and colors and different types of application, so it turns out to be a more fulfilling and all-encompassing sense of expression. Sketching became very one-dimensional, whereas painting, at least for me, feels like a much deeper means of expression because of the complexity. I paint with vibrant colors, and I paint without any real foundation of color relationships. Does a field of wildflowers know anything about color relationships? No, but it all somehow works and affirms the beauty of harmony through diversity. I paint with spirit. Color affirms life. And the more I paint, the more that point of view manifests itself in my paintings, the more I see it is true. The more I paint and visualize how I see life, the more it becomes true. As far as being able to conceive of things differently today than I did yesterday, I see the colorful aspect of my painting affecting other aspects of my life. I recently made amazing campanelli pasta with sausage and broccoli rub and toasted panko crumbs. It was off the charts. For some reason, up to that point, I had overlooked one of the basic rules of cooking vegetables. Keep vegetables like broccoli vibrant in color. This time, after I blanched the broccoli rub, I put it in ice water, and it retained its bright green color. Now my food looks like my paintings. And if and when I write songs again, I will bring to my music everything that I've done since last I wrote. I have absolutely no doubt that the music will have color. The beauty of creative outlets is that they allow us to make a tangible manifestation of our outlook. And when we do creative work, we validate that outlook. When we make beautiful music or beautiful art, the world is more beautiful. Though, of course, we have to start somewhere, and it's not always from a beautiful place. When I first started painting, for instance, some of my early creations were almost like exorcisms. I needed to get that out to move on. The process of doing it was a cathartic way to move forward. I would want to hang myself if 20 years later I was painting the same images. But it was a way to purge, a way to acknowledge and face how I was feeling, a way to make a reality out of an emotion and look at it. It wasn't how I wanted to feel, but sometimes we have to acknowledge and validate where we are to move on. Those early paintings raised a lot of hard feelings in me. And yet today, I see them as beautiful, because they're a mile marker of where I was compared to where I am. Not unlike going to my old street in Washington Heights and seeing my old apartment. There's where I was. Look at me now. The downside, the hurt, is gone. I can see how far I've come. I can see similar examples when I look back at songs from the past. Generally speaking, I was uncomfortable with the Kiss album Carnival of Souls. My issue with it was that I had never wanted to write songs reflecting dissatisfaction and unhappiness, or looking at the world negatively. Putting on a hat of misery felt fake and disingenuous because of my belief in fighting through things, because of my fundamental optimism. In the midst of this artificial doom and gloom, and the personal turmoil of my looming divorce, I did, however, have a creative epiphany I could apply. I realized that the only person I could swear I would always be there for was my flesh and blood, Evan. So there's one song on that album, I Will Be There, that affirmed my commitment to my child and also pretty much acknowledged that although other things were going to change, that one thing wouldn't. Now I can look at that mile marker and see that I kept that promise to my child, even through my personal trials and tribulations. My current musical side project, Soul Station, is another type of creative outlet, one of those why versus why not scenarios. The original idea was to be able to hear some of my favorite music and to have a band unlike any I'd ever had before, with every possible ethnicity and every possible background, with horn players and singers and two keyboard players, and this great diversity all held together by a passion for the music. Vintage, soul, and R&B. It's been so invigorating, so joyous, and we love it so much. To establish this commonality and celebration together is another amazing affirmation of what we're all capable of doing. These people have individually played with everybody. Getting to know these people, who under other circumstances I would never have met, and laughing and eating and practicing together, it's a miracle. Of course, everyone has these sorts of opportunities in one way or another, and we either shut them down or take advantage of them. Not that everybody has to have a soul station, but everybody has desires, And either we live with later saying, I wish I had, or we do it. It's another example of how much richer our lives can be when we embrace and go for something. Soul Station offers the chance to hear songs that I love, that are so much a part of my foundation and musical fabric, played live and spirited and with such joy and commitment. It would be great enough just to listen to the music, but to be a part of it is incredible. To be a participant and to be a part of this creation is exhilarating. And not only are people blown away by it and the authenticity of it, but I'm blown away by the joy of being a part of it. Like in many other things I've done in my life, I didn't understand the scope of what I could get back from attempting something new or from seeing it through. It not only gives me a validation of the beauties in life, but also has given me a new village. It has given me band members I never knew, and their friendship and their support, and they look at me the same way. In life, we look for externals instead of trying to find ways to get to the internal. At the end of the day, the sense of belonging and knowing who we are and where we are and that we're loved and valued is the core of a much more fulfilling life. We can experience that in so many different ways. This incredible band of musicians from diverse backgrounds who joined me in this quest to pay homage to a music that's so important to all of us has become one way. And on top of that, we get to experience one another, socialize, have dinners together. I cook for them. We're all embracing each other. We're all getting something from one another that makes each one of us more fulfilled and more complete. If I hadn't taken the steps leading up to the eventual creation of Soul Station, I would have never gained this experience. Everything starts with the first step, and where that first step takes us is what makes it so exciting. Originally, I was doing a fundraiser for my kid's school, and I had put together a great band doing classic rock covers. The following year, I thought, I would love to do those songs, since my roots are as much in Philly soul and Motown as in British rock. I made some phone calls and put together a band. It was so much fun that over the course of a year or so, it developed into Soul Station, a bona fide touring band. So the first step was allowing myself to do something that people around me were skeptical about. When I told the sound people who worked with Kiss that I was going to do a Motown Philly R&B band, they said, "Who's going to sing?" And when I said, "I'm going to sing," they looked at me like I was out of my mind. Well, after the first show, they said, "Dude, we were wrong." Rod Stewart said the same thing to me. "Who's singing?" "Me," I said. And he said, "You can handle those songs?" As I played Rod a live recording, his jaw dropped and he broke into a wide grin and said, "Wow." Why not? Giving ourselves the license to do something is the start. Like everything else that I've accumulated and done in my life, I can't imagine not having Soul Station any more than I can imagine not painting, any more than I can imagine not cooking. You just go down the list. All these things have become essential to who I am. That's what everyone needs to find for themselves. We don't know what all it could be unless we give ourselves the license to explore. If you're considering exploring something new, do it. You have much more to gain than you do to lose. If we don't do it, we live with regret. I'd rather live with failure, because even failure can lead somewhere else. Doing nothing leads nowhere. One thing people seem to hear a lot at Kiss shows of late is, "Gee, I've never seen Paul smile so much. I've never seen him have so much fun on stage." It's true. I bring that same joy to Kiss. I'm dead serious about what I do in the band, and I give it 100% of what I have, which may not be the same as 100% 40 years ago, but the joy of being up there, the joy of playing with those guys, the joy of every other aspect of my life means I get to bring all that on stage with Kiss. it makes it better. It makes it deeper and gives people a much more well-rounded sense of the band. It's less one-dimensional. There's a human being who's exhilarated and basking in that moment. Everything I do is a celebration of life. Everything I do is a validation of my potential. Painting is a celebration of life because it's a validation of a creative outlet, of taking the intangible and making something tangible. Doing theater was a celebration of life because it affirmed the potential that we all have to explore different sides of ourselves. Kiss is the same thing. I don't really distinguish. How we live is a celebration of life, or should be. All that I'm involved in, and all the passion and energy I put into these things, affirms life in general. I'm in awe of life. When Kiss started, it wasn't a celebration of life as much as a celebration of the right to be yourself and to follow your dreams. It wasn't about rebellion for rebellion's sake, but about fighting the status quo, fighting the system. But we could only do that for so long. Once we succeeded on a big scale, then it became a celebration of life. We became the living proof that you can believe in yourself, work against the system, and win. That's what Kiss celebrates at this point. And if we can do it, you can do it. Earlier in life, many of us might be more robotic, more like automatons, but eventually we become more human. Maybe one of the reasons I feel younger than I am is because I feel like I was born later than I was actually born. My childhood was lived at an older age. Yeah, I don't feel 67. Perhaps because so many of the things that I find most rewarding started late. It's almost not fair to say that I feel young, because when I was young, I didn't have these positive sensations. I live more now. Back then, I was young in age, but my spirit was old or broken. As corny as it sounds, my life is filled with wonder. That's the reality of it. The excitement is never ending. I never know where it will go next. And living this way is a conscious decision. And that's the important takeaway from this book. I always like when people are surprised by something I do and say to me, "What's next?" I have no idea. But those new challenges are the things that define each of us. Maybe today we aren't aware of where we're going to go or what we're going to do. But that's how we get to know who we are. By the unanticipated challenges we take on, by the things we embrace, and by how we deal with them. How do we define ourselves? The more things we do, the more goes into that definition. I'm very, very grateful and feel incredibly fulfilled by creative outlets I had never even considered, which makes me think I have no idea what's next. Can I see the end? Sure. As I've said, life is like a conveyor belt, and I can remember having everyone in front of me. Now I can see that most people are behind me. That's coming to grips with our own mortality and the fact that when we're younger, life seems infinite. We can't conceive of it ending. When it starts to seem finite, people sometimes find God. It's inconceivable for many people to think of the world continuing without them, so they have to believe, rightly or wrongly, that they're going somewhere else after they die. I certainly can't say whether or not that's true, but it's very much human nature for people to believe that the world revolves around them. I believe in God, but not because I have any notion of going anywhere after I'm done here. The concept of God, whatever that is to each person, simply makes the world more beautiful. I don't know what God is. I don't know where we are, but believing in God gives me some sense of grounding and wonder. One of the things that's been staggering to me is that fans who are in the final stages of their lives often want to connect with me. It's humbling, though Grasping the magnitude of it is also difficult. About 18 months ago, I got a call from a woman whose friend was married to a gentleman who was in his last days of life. He was a huge Kiss fan. He'd been a chef at a restaurant out here. I went to their house to sit with him. It was tough to face the reality that this amazing life and this man's plans, which I'm sure were as long-range and as far-reaching as mine, were in their final stages. I sat with him and told him that no one could tell him what he needed to do, that I was there with him, and that I believed we'd meet again. Whenever I've met people who are dying, I always feel the need to tell them that it's up to them to decide what happens next, and that, for whatever it's worth, I support them in that. The idea that someone would get joy or hope or strength from me is such a gift. I certainly never got that. It's hard to articulate how stirring it is to be able to give someone that just by being. A few years ago, someone called me and told me that a young man in a hospital wanted to speak to me. I called him and told him that he was in my prayers, and I supported him. "This isn't anyone else's fight but yours," I told him. "And you have to decide where you are in this battle. If you feel it's time to let go, no one knows but you, and nobody can tell you but you. If it means anything to you, I support your decision." I called back a few days later, and his mother said he had just waited to hear from me. And then he passed away. There's no end game. There's no point of arrival. There's no finish line. I always picture death as going through swinging doors on a stretcher. You go in, and you never come out. That's when, as far as I know, it ends. I'm going to live every moment up until then. That's the only finish line that doesn't lead to another. Other than making wise decisions about health or safety, that's the one I have no say in. But up until then, I do have a say in what goes on, and I'm going to make sure that I'm smiling right up until the end. Outro. Some Kiss fans may be doctors, and some may need doctors, but they're all united in their common love of Kiss. The lengths to which members of the Kiss Army and Kiss Navy go to show their allegiance are legendary. And when they tattoo my Star Child face on their bodies, it's humbling. It points to my responsibility. My commitment must be worthy of theirs. That may sound cheesy, but it's what got me this far. A belief in myself, a standard I owe to the people who put me where I am, as well as to myself, and a joy in doing what I do. Kiss has always been the underdog, and the band champions those like us. We hope to inspire people through our accomplishments. We have always been relentless in pursuing our goals, and the audience can sense the genuine nature of our passion. It's at the core of everything I do. Over the course of more than 2,500 concerts, I've thrown myself into every show. There is no substitute for a performer's commitment. No way to fake it. And the same is true in life. We have to do things properly, never lowering the bar. I suppose we can find ways to fool other people, but ultimately this undermines our own view of ourselves. If we don't do a job as well as we can, it's hard to look in the mirror. I owe myself better. You owe yourself better. We all owe ourselves better. And there is a reward in doing things properly. We build up a sense of self and take home a great feeling when we've given our best. As I've said, nothing of any value comes without work, and we find out how important something is to us by how hard we are willing to work to achieve it. But I had to figure out how to work toward goals, and I found that everything is accomplished incrementally. A clean room starts with one thing being picked up, and that's the most effective way to deal with life. Look at what needs to be done, and then start with doing one thing. What's great about starting to work on something and doing one thing at a time, whether it's getting in shape or launching a business, is that the task becomes much less overwhelming. If I had known how long it was going to take me to become a good guitar player, I never would have picked up the instrument in the first place.
Or when I look at a tour itinerary and see 100 shows, I break out in a sweat.
How am I ever going to do this? Well, I do it one show at a time. One single show, 100 times. The same was true for me with therapy. I went to therapy to get some answers. That was 40 years ago. If I had realized that I was going to have to figure out the answers myself and that there was no quick fix, I probably would have just gotten high instead. Or take surgery. I don't fear it because I can't start working toward my goal of recovery until I get past the surgery. I see injuries as minor setbacks to living my life to the fullest. As long as we keep going forward, at some point we will turn around and see where we started. The first day? Sucked. The first week sucked. But here I am with 2 weeks behind me. Whether it's surgery or anything else, I look forward to having it happen because then it's one day behind me. I'm one day closer to the goal. We can't do anything that we're not willing to start. Kiss is a tribe at this point, and unlike most bands that are very age and demographic specific, we don't have a stigma. If a fan's younger brother or sister shows up, if the fan's father or mother shows up, if the fan's grandmother or grandfather shows up, it's all good. It's about being a member of the biggest cult in the world, of a secret society that is life-changing, life-affirming, and something you ultimately want to share. We are multi-generational and proud of it. Kiss has long been heralded as the people's band because of the community we have created and the spirit of celebration that infuses all that we do. We don't preach, we inspire. Which is a long way of saying I've been successful by being an everyman. I think people look at me for inspiration because they see their attributes and their flaws in me, just as they see them in themselves. Meaning, if I can do it, perhaps everyone can, with a little guidance and support. That also explains why this book is a total package. Because what I found is that it's not about what we can accomplish. It's more about how we can accomplish it. In my case, I don't attribute my success to a certain way of working out or eating any more than I attribute it to positive thinking. Those things are part of it, of course, but what it's really about is a point of view, a way of facing the day, a way of taking control of my life. I try to apply the same determination and passion, even in areas some might dismiss as trivial. Some people might not think it helps us professionally to cook up a nice meal at home, for instance. But it does. Everything is connected, and when we affect one thing, we affect everything. We raise the level of everything we do. The Kiss Rider, the list of things promoters are contractually obligated to have for us backstage, has changed a lot over the years. Early on, we used to order champagne by the case. Then we switched to Dr. Pepper. Our rider these days is surprisingly dull. The only drug anyone wants backstage is Advil. But part of the reward of success should be hard-earned knowledge, lessons learned, realizations and epiphanies across many aspects of life, not just in music and business. It's not that I want to limit myself to what might be called age-appropriate behavior, but I'm glad to have different priorities, to be a little wiser. This is probably why people come up to me all the time and say things like, "You inspired me to become a doctor," or "You got me through a troubled time in my life." I met a man recently who told me he was a 2-time cancer survivor. What got him through the days when he couldn't get off the sofa, he told me, was listening to Kiss. I would like to think that we All can inspire one another to become the best we can be, to fully realize who we are by seeing how others have done it. We can emulate the passion and determination and apply it to anything in life. Part of what's so difficult for most of us is feeling that we're alone in our struggles. But if we open up to the right people, we find out there's actually a lot of support around us because we're all dealing with the same stuff. When we idolize someone, we tend to see that person as perfect. And I'd rather people look at me and realize that where I am today didn't come without a lot of hard work, pain, and defeats. Do I have it all? Yeah, I really do. I have the satisfaction of a great job and a great family, and they enhance each other. But anyone can have it all. People compromise. Too often they surrender and settle in relationships, in jobs, in life. But the truth is, we can have it all. And we owe it to ourselves to at least try. I want everybody to succeed. The top of the mountain is really big. There's room for everyone. Just remember that our stories never end. Your story never ends. At some point, it simply gets added to someone else's and passed forward to be told again. It's up to you to make sure you love yours. Addendum. Life can and should be an adventure of discovery. And for me, what makes that possible and what it all comes down to is family. And by that I mean both actual family members and those people we embrace as such. My growth and self-awareness over the years continue to be reflections of my interactions with and support from those people I am fortunate to have placed around me. I would be remiss and perhaps undeserving if I weren't to understand how deeply rooted together Jean and I are. True love and true friendship are built over years of action and reaction. There is no substitute for time, and time does tell all. When I had my first operation to rebuild my ear from rib cartilage, Jean flew up to see me in the hospital, despite an intense fear of flying at the time. When I was separated from my first wife and didn't know where to go, Jean opened his home to me without hesitation, and I lived there for months. He paid for a big surprise birthday party when I turned 61, but didn't want me to know. The list is endless. The depth of our relationship, too, is endless. When Evan, my first child, was born, the very first person I admitted into the delivery room, almost immediately, was Jean. He was that important to me. In 1994, during a very strained time between us, when we were barely speaking, Los Angeles was rocked by a large, damaging earthquake. Regardless of our personal situation at the time, once I recovered from the initial shocks, the first person I called to see whether he was all right was Jean. We continue, 49 years later, to enjoy each other and annoy each other. He is now a happily married man with a family that years ago wasn't remotely on the horizon for him, nor did it hold any attraction. But isn't that what makes life so rich and exciting? We never know what the future holds, but we are transformed by being open to possibilities that allow us the opportunity to rise to them. Do Jean and I bicker? Sure. Do we disagree? Of course. It's all small and vastly inconsequential given what we have, what we share, and what we have built. I don't understand some of what Jean does. I don't agree with some of what Jean says, but time tells all, and I am blessed that he has been such a pivotal person in my life, and that I was smart enough to realize it. I know many people. Those I consider my true friends, I can count on my 10 fingers, which brings me to those I love. I can count them on those same 10 fingers and still have some to spare. Thankfully for me, Jean is right there with my family. I believe that if we don't know that we are blessed, then we don't deserve to be. Life's potential becomes so much richer and more meaningful when we embrace the blessings we have been given and come to discover the endless ones that are, in fact, there for our taking, and others for our making. Onward. This is Sean Pratt. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Backstage Pass by Paul Stanley, presented by Harper One and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Falley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Jennifer Lopes. Text copyright 2019 by Paul Stanley. Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.